Ma'arib. On Thursday, Ansarullah deployed troops to the city of Ma'arib, which is a stronghold of loyalists of the former Yemeni government. The Daesh terrorist group has also openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside Saudi-backed mercenaries against Yemen's army and popular forces in the province of Ma'arib. Well, the country has been devastated by a war waged by Saudi Arabia and its allies since March 2015. The kingdom has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered aid imports to Yemen.
The fighting is escalating in the city of Ma'arib, which is the last stronghold of the Saudi-backed forces in the north of the war-torn country. On Thursday, the Ansarullah movement and allied army units ordered a wide deployment of troops to Ma'arib, saying the move is aimed at protecting Yemeni citizens. The deployment came as reports surfaced suggesting grave human rights violations by Riyadh loyalists. Yemen's Supreme Council for Management of Humanitarian Affairs said Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Ma'arib. The council said Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Meanwhile, the Saudi-led coalition has also redeployed troops to the region and increased airstrikes against Ansarullah positions there. The United Nations has urged warring sides to stop their offensive on Ma'arib and called for an immediate ceasefire.
The attack on Ma'arib must stop. It puts millions of civilians at risk, as Mark has been commenting this week, and especially with the fighting threatening to reach camps for internally displaced persons.
The UN also warned about a looming famine in Yemen, which the world body said would be the worst on the planet in decades due to years of war. UN humanitarian chief Mark Lowcock said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen, including 5 million who are just one step away from famine. The UN official also highlighted the high records of malnutrition rate among Yemeni people. Yemen has been devastated by the war waged by Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the US and European countries, such as Britain and France in March 2015. The kingdom has conducted airstrikes on its southern impoverished neighbor almost on a daily basis. It has also imposed an all-out blockade that has hampered even humanitarian aid deliveries to Yemen. The new US administration has been making a fuss about ending the Saudi war on Yemen and ensuring that humanitarian aid reached the Yemeni people. Despite the claims, Washington has failed to take practical measures to push its major regional allies, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, to end their deadly war against their conflict-plagued Arab country.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Kim Sharif, joining us from the British capital, London. Also, we have Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El Najem, joining us from Toronto. Welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Ms. Sharif in London. Yemen's Supreme Council of Humanitarian Affairs has reported that Saudi-backed militants are using civilians and displaced people as human shields in the ongoing clashes in Yemen's city of Ma'arib, and that Saudi Arabia and its allies bear responsibility for endangering civilian lives. Talk to us more about that also. That condemnation has not been echoed by the likes of the UN or the United States. And also, if you may, tell us, why is the Ma'arib battle so vital right now?
Well, good evening to you, and thank you for the invite to join the debate. Basically, the background to what's happening in Ma'arib in particular is that the oil of Yemen was being stolen and continues to be stolen by the Western-backed Saudi coalition team and their mercenaries. And of course, the income from all that oil revenue was being diverted for the purchase of hotels, villas, and lots of other real estate properties in Cairo, in Istanbul, and even in London. I have seen evidence of that. Basically, what's happening is that the international community doesn't want the Yemen army and its popular committees to advance in Ma'arib because it stands to lose a great deal of oil revenue that it's stealing from Yemen today. I'm not just making this claim. This matter was being investigated by the French authorities, I believe, about a year ago. We revealed that about 4 years ago that Yemen oil was being stolen in favor of the Saudi-led coalition via the French oil giant Total. And I believe that investigation is still ongoing. And that's one of the reasons why they don't want the Yemen army to advance in Marib. That's one point. The second point is, as your reporter has just confirmed, the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world in Yemen today are fighting alongside Saudi-led coalition forces. I'm glad they have finally come out and confirmed this. This was confirmed by BBC report Safar Ahmed. This was confirmed by CNN, whereby American weapons are ending up in the hands of ACAP and Daesh. This has been confirmed by what we found when we regained Al Baida. We found nationalities from Chechnya, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from many other countries. All the known usual terrorists were there. Why? What are they doing in Al Baida? They were brought in there by the Saudi-led coalition. They don't have ground forces. Their ground forces consist of terrorist outfits such as Daesh and ACAP, as well as mercenaries they get from Sudan, Senegal, and elsewhere. That's the other reason. They want Yemen to continue to have terrorism problems so that it can give the right. Americans and their allies the right to come and attack Yemen, as they have been doing for the past 60 years. So we don't have terrorism in the past controlled by Sana'a government by comparison. You will see that Sana'a government is the only one that's fighting terrorism in Yemen today.
Ms. Sharif, hold that thought. Let's bring in our guest from Toronto, Mr. Firas al-Najim. The United Nations says that Yemen is speeding towards the worst famine on the planet. Top UN officials have also warned that this massive famine could wipe out any fresh peace efforts. The UN humanitarian chief, Mark Lowcock, said 16 million people are going hungry across Yemen. Yet we're still witnessing international inaction to relieve the suffering of the Yemeni people. Why has this war been dragged out for so long?
Well, you know, it's quite clear we want this war to keep dragging on and keep going because there's a plan behind it. And the U.S. and the British and the French are the ones giving all the logistical support to this war. Like, they're behind and they have, some of the strongest power inside the United Nations. And it's up to them to delay this war. It's up to them to stop this war. It's up to them to put sanctions against Saudi Arabia. We know Saudi Arabia is one of the biggest human rights violators in the whole Middle Eastern region. We know that they are a monarchy, tribal, tyrannical regime that does not respect human rights whatsoever. They don't have any human rights organizations operating inside their country. We see what they do to their own civilians in their country. We see what they do to any opposition members inside their country. We see what they do to other countries when people stand up for their rights, such as Bahrain, and they intervened and they went there and they occupied that place as well. They've been committing massive amounts of human rights abuses and massacres, war crimes in Yemen. We've been seeing it now. We're going into 6 years of a war, right? And we know it's obviously an illegitimate war from the beginning because the Yemeni people rose up peacefully to change the system that's there. We've heard Mark speak before. We've heard Ban Ki-moon before, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, speaking about it's the worst famine, it's the worst humanitarian crisis. But what's been done? When has Saudi Arabia ever been and their coalition held accountable for all these human rights abuses and all these war crimes? Nothing. We hear it sometimes. One time there was a certain labeling of tribes by the United Nations, and then they pulled back and retracted that because of some bullying, because of some bribing, because of some blackmail. I mean, this is what the United Nations is today. Today, United Nations is a tool for certain countries, and they can exercise the plans that they want and the projects they want. And then before they said we'll pull out of the International Criminal Court, we won't even recognize them. We won't recognize the Human Rights Commission inside the United Nations. They said it was, it's not operating right, so we just pull out. So pretty much we don't even care about what's happening within human rights in the United Nations. So it's a very biased system. It's a very unfair system. And, Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis. We see the pictures every day. We've seen the famine. We've seen the children dying. Where is humanity? That's the question. Where is all these countries that are still ongoing and justifying supplying arms deals? You know, Canada, one of the countries that I'm living in here, our government here is supplying the biggest arms deal to Saudi Arabia continuously, and it's continuing, even though they know what's happening in Yemen.
Okay.
You know, this hypocrisy must stop, and we as you...
Let's cross over back to London, Kim Sharif. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an anti-U.S. support for the Saudi Iranian-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration in Washington is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war and the crisis there. The question is, will Washington act on those comments? Because ending support doesn't mean that the war will just end.
Indeed. We have had nothing but total hypocrisy from the U.S. regime. I mean, Mr. Biden must be reminded that his administration was in charge when this aggression on Yemen was announced in Washington on 26 March 2015. And if it hadn't been for U.S.'s full backing, and I actually suspect a command to the Saudi-led coalition to put together this coalition and attack Yemen, this war wouldn't have started in the first place. There is no mandate from the UN to invite or to allow anyone to use force against Yemen. If it hadn't been for U.S. bullying and involvement, and as I said, I sincerely believe this is U.S.'s war. And this is Mr. Biden's attempt at trying to play the Mr. Nice diplomat now that they have failed miserably in occupying Yemen completely and colonizing it, which is what they wanted to do from the start. And now between Britain and the U.S., they're playing the good cop, the bad cop scenario on us, whereby Britain continues to supply weapons, but the U.S. will start to play the nice diplomat who is going to make every effort to stop. For God's sake, it's very straightforward. If he really is genuine about what he's saying, I put him to the test here by inviting Mr. Biden to go to the Security Council tomorrow and pass a resolution demanding forthwith cessation of hostilities against the state of Yemen by the Saudi-led coalition and forthwith lifting of the illegal blockade. And then I will believe him and trust him. But then meanwhile he continues to make these statements, look, we need to see action on the ground. We don't want empty statements and good cop, bad cop scenario won't work with us. Yes. Let's just trace it. Saudi-led coalition have been defeated. They are using civilians as a human shield in Marib, simply because they are terrified witless. Once Marib has returned to the sovereignty of the state of Yemen, that is basically the end of Saudi-led coalition. They will have no leg to stand in continuing their aggression against Yemen, which is why their Western backers are also making noises about Marib. They're saying all warring parties. What do you mean by all warring parties? This is an aggression by the U.S. Okay. and the U.K. through Saudi-led coalition.
Mr. Al-Najm, I saw you nodding there, reacting to the news of Joe Biden's comments that the U.S. wants to stop its support for the Saudi aggression. Yemen's Supreme Political Council back then said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. They want to see action also. Why should the Yemenis even trust Washington? In fact, just as Ms. Sharif just mentioned, in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Mr. Biden, that gave Riyadh the support in the first place.
Yes, that's very clear. Obviously, that Obama sparked this war at his time, and this person Biden is on the same system and same team, and he's gonna be, when he's promoting for his campaign, he's gonna try to use all kinds of different, marketing tools to get into power, that he's gonna stop this and stop that. But like, he came in right now, and we see now the war is intensifying in Marib and different areas. He could easily pull the plug on the Saudis and stop this war and stop the arms deal right ahead and adopt a resolution in the United Nations to stop the war, right? They got veto power inside the United Nations. So it's a very easy war. The Saudi regime itself is living on the oxygen tank of the American system and regime. So it's very quickly. The thing is, they just don't want resistance in the area. I would like to add to Kim's comment about how this is, it's also there to secure Israel. So it's a U.S.-Israeli war, pretty much. And it's there to secure the interest of securing Israel, because they know that Ansar Allah are part of the axis or the unity of the resistance groups in the Middle East. And this all sparked at the time of 1979, where Imam Khomeini did his revolution, and he fought the colonial powers that they want to control the area, all these, Western countries that want to set up their bases and start wars and sell arms to these guys and fund the resources of the region. And Ansar Allah is part of that axis, and they are. This is a very dangerous area because of Bab Bab al-Mandab also, it's a water pathway that is needed for them to bring their ships and their, you know, dock all their planes on there, their fighter jets, and bring in all their supplies to support Israel and to support the control and the bases of the region. So, this is their main danger. They don't want a strong government, a sovereign government, a legitimate government. What is Ansarullah? Ansarullah has other political factions that are all Yemeni, and they're people that were inside the country. They didn't come from outside. There's not one Iranian person inside Iran, except maybe the ambassador that just recently got in there. So this is a very big joke whenever they say the Iranians are behind this, the Iranians are running the show. Where is the Iranians? You have not captured one Iranian. Have you had one prisoner of war that's Iranian till now, so you can even show some kind of credibility or even justify or even make up a scenario? They haven't even been able to make up a scenario where they find some Iranians, you know, and do something like this. This shows that everything they're doing is illegitimate, it's fraudulent, it's all fake, and it's all evil. And, you know, the only way it's going to happen, I think, is by the Yemeni unity and their defense and their deterrence. Like, these guys are, you know, they're powerful. Like, you know, when Biden had to pull their name off the terrorist list, this shows how strong they are and how big of negotiators they're going to be in the future. So we believe that the Yemeni government, Ansarullah, the Houthis are the victorious ones, and they will defeat all these coalitions.
Kim Sharif, we were talking about Joe Biden's campaign trail. On the campaign trail, Joe Biden said, and I quote, "We will in fact make the Saudis the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." Well, the Saudis right now, they aren't even on the UN's child killer blacklist. What does that mean?
Well, it's quite right. I'm glad you make that quote, because these were quite a few of his quotes before the election. He made the mandate. He promised the people of the US that if he is voted into power, he will do these things. But so far, not so good. The one good thing he's done is obviously removing the designation that was quite irrational and frankly illegal and unworkable, because it's designating the entire Yemeni population as terrorists, which is impossible. The only terrorists in Yemen are those people working for them, ACAP and Daesh, as they have quite clearly made a statement yesterday confirming that. Joe Biden, I mean, I want to tell you about another important thing. He said he was going to care for children. What about women? Last couple of weeks, Saudi-led coalition mercenaries in Marib kidnapped 8 women, beaten them with their gun butts and pulled their hairs. One of them just gave birth 2 weeks earlier. They refused to let her take her child to breastfeed. One of the 8 women was tortured to death, and 7 of them were sold on to Saudi regime. That is human trafficking in a worst case scenario in the middle of this war. These women have done nothing. They were mere internally displaced people living in tents and places like that. And so Joe Biden, just like many other Western politicians, they say something, but then in reality, they do completely the opposite. And they always find good excuses to get away from it. At the moment, so far, it sounds like he has avoided speaking to Bin Salman. He hasn't spoken to him, and he made statements that if he is to deal with the Saudi regime, he's going to be communicating with Salman directly, and good luck to him, and know how to manage Alzheimer's situations. I hope he does. So he needs to do more than just say, I'm not going to be on speaking terms with this man who stands accused of brutally murdering Khashoggi in breach of all kinds of laws, laws of the heavens and laws of the earth, and disrespect to other people's jurisdictions and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we need to see more from Mr. Biden. He's now past the stage of election sound bites. He's now in power. He needs to act as the real president, right, and do the right thing and go and pass that resolution at the UN Security Council and deal with Sana'a government directly in the usual diplomatic channels, okay, because he will find them the best partners in the war against terror.
One last question for Mr. Al-Najim in Toronto before we leave. The Daesh terrorist group has openly confirmed that its members are fighting alongside the Saudi-backed mercenaries in Marib. A lot of other data points in the direction that the Saudi-led coalition and its mercenaries and even Washington have been fighting alongside Takfiri terror outfits such as Daesh and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Share with us your thoughts on that issue before we leave.
Well, I mean, it's nothing, shocking at all, because the Wahhabi state-sponsored doctrine of Saudi Arabia, that's their, that's what they are. They're the Wahhabi sect, and the Wahhabi sect is the doctrine that's a deviant, and that is an extremist doctrine that has, obviously is far away from the real Islam. And these people are working based on this doctrine right now, and they just don't have a government. So they're just, lawless people on the ground.
All right. We're fresh out of time of this program. Allow me to thank my guest, Director of Human Rights for Yemen, Ms. Kim Shadiff, joining us from London. Also, thanks to manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najem, speaking to us from Toronto. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. In this episode, we'll be talking about one of the great individuals in history, not only Islamic history, but history, human history, and about a concept that all individuals, all peoples see this concept as being a concept that is worth fighting for, a concept that is worth having. And we see that this individual and this concept go hand in hand, hence the name of the title of this book. And even the author of this book, who's not even Muslim, who will be mentioned hopefully during the process or during the time of our session, in our episode, will see that, he himself, not being Muslim, understood this, that these two concepts, rather the concept and the individual, are inseparable. The concept is justice. That wherever we are, wherever, we will live, or, whatever nationality we are, whatever language we speak, the concept of justice is something that we are all seeking. Justice is what? That you put every single thing in its proper place. Adl. And that person who signifies this, the greatest after the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, is none other than the first Imam, the cousin of the Holy Prophet, the son-in-law of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that is Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, the one who was born in this blessed month of Rajab. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, by the right of this blessed month, to increase our knowledge and our ma'rifah, that the deep understanding of this individual in this specific month, which is the month of the birth of this precious and this eloquent and this esteemed individual. So we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for this, especially in this blessed month of Rajab. Inshallah, my dear brothers and sisters, my dear listeners, we will introduce the book, The Voice of Human Justice, in a more expansive manner in our next segment. So please stay tuned until then. Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program, Bookshelf, on IRIB English Radio. And we are currently discussing the book, The Voice of Human Justice. This book is an English translation of the original Arabic that was known as Sawt al-Adalat al-Insaniya. This book was a biography written on Imam Ali alayhi salam in, as I mentioned, Arabic, by a Christian Lebanese author whose name was George Jordan. This book has gained a lot of popularity and a lot of praise in the Arab and Muslim world. Now, obviously, in Arab world, not everybody in the Arab world is Muslim. There are many Christians in the Arab world, George Jordan being one. And he is not the only non-Muslim Arab to write about Imam Ali alayhi salam. But this is one of the most popular books that we have. It must also be noted that this English translation is only a part of the original book. The original book is written in 5 volumes. So this 1-volume book we have in English is an abridged and extracted version of those 5 volumes. So, but it is beneficial regardless. And this translation is only a part of that complete set. So this book consists of 31 different chapters, and most of the chapters are looking at the history of the government of Imam alayhi salam, especially his administration, the way he looked at the orphans, some of them how he dealt with his enemies. It also looks at certain historical events that happened before the rule, for example, the Khilafat of Uthman, and some events that happened after the rule of Imam Ali alayhi salam. For example, the chapter that deals with Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Yazid, and obviously the event and the tragedy of Karbala. What must also be known about this book, that is The Voice of Human Justice, is that it is a seminal work. It is a book that is academic. So therefore, the author obviously went and found out certain sources, certain references that he found and he felt would have been worthy of mention. So therefore, it is based upon the opinions of the author, that is George Jordan. And therefore, there may be certain things within the book that go against or do not conform with the mainstream and the common Islamic view on Imam Ali alayhi salam, on the government of Imam Ali Islam, on certain Islamic historical things. So this is one thing that dear listeners, the dear brothers and sisters who are listening to the program should understand, that you are reading a book by a person who is not Muslim, but it's an academic work. Therefore, it is not necessary that everything will be to the mainstream view. It is something that this person wishes to bring, and is new ideas he wishes to bring. He wishes to emphasize on certain points that may not have been emphasized or may not have been shown in other historical works on the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So this is one point that our dear brothers and sisters must keep in mind. The book was translated by Muhammad Fazl Haq and published by Al Khoi Foundation in the UK. And as I mentioned, the book consists of the events that occurred in Islamic history, especially during the life and the government of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will mention or read a segment from the book, The Voice of Human Justice, by George Jordan. Inshallah, until then. Welcome back, my dear listeners, to this, the third segment of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. And we have been discussing and introducing to you the book, The Voice of Human Justice, written by the Christian Arab scholar George Jordan. And as we mentioned, it is a book, rather the translation is merely a part of a larger set of books. But for our benefit and the benefit of our dear listeners, we will read a small segment of this book. This segment is taken from the very first chapter, which deals with Imam Ali alayhi salam and his relationship to the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So the chapter is titled The Prophet and Ali.
A very good and pure spirit existed in the family of Abu Talib. He looked at the world in a peculiar manner and saw all things connected and united with one another. This spirit was very strong in the Prophet and Ali, and a very firm relationship existed between them. Because Ali had been brought up by the Prophet from his childhood till he grew up to be a youth. When we admit that it is possible that good morals should become firm naturally in a heart and a soul, we have also to say that Ali was born with perfect faith in the prophethood of Muhammad and support for him, because the qualities and virtues of the family of Abu Talib in which the Prophet was brought up were transferred to his cousin from his birth. The personality of Ali developed with the virtues of his family. It was this place where he heard Muhammad speak, and the call to Islam also started from here. Ali was quite young when the Prophet attached him with himself and called him his brother. So this is a part, and we can see that George Jordak emphasizes the relationship between these two individuals, and that this relationship was one of the main causes in the characteristics and the traits that made up the behavior and the character and the personality of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Inshallah, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam to increase us in knowledge and to keep us a better understanding of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Venezuela's Congress, also known as the National Assembly, has requested the government of President Nicolas Maduro to expel European Union Ambassador Isabel Brillante out of the South American nation as a diplomatic action countering the recently launched sanctions from the EU against the Bolivarian Republic. The Maduro administration has denounced the European measures, describing them as illegal and harmful to the economy of Venezuela. Venezuelan officials say that the EU, along with the US government, are plotting to produce a humanitarian crisis in the Latin American country in order to bring down President Nicolas Maduro. Although a UN human rights envoy recently declared foreign sanctions on Venezuela have no legal basis and must be lifted, the EU has ratified its decision. Venezuelan authorities claim they will legally confront the sanctions.
Okay, van 34 meses.
The EU, just like the US, is criminally targeting Venezuela. However, this unfair aggression will not oust Maduro.
Meanwhile, in the opposition, some say elections in Venezuela would ease the elimination of sanctions.
If free elections were held here, all foreign sanctions would blow over, but Maduro refuses to do so.
Nonetheless, socialists insist that neither the EU nor the US can judge what free elections are.
We have already had free elections guaranteed by many foreign observers, so the EU and the US are lying for political purposes.
Caracas slams the EU over violating international law with illegal sanctions. The expelling of the European ambassador is widely seen as a response to the bloc's economic policies against Venezuela. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus. Organized and hosted by Bacayatullah University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Bacayatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Bacayatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial. Covpars, which is a recombinant vaccine, and Coviran, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Bacayatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The passage of time will never let the world forget the war crimes former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein committed against the innocent Iranian people. As part of its heinous crimes, the Iraqi dictator bombarded northwestern city of Sardash in 1978, killing 119 innocent civilians and exposing more than 8,000 to toxic gases, which maimed them forever. But Saddam was not alone in this 8-year war, and there were several countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the US, that assisted him by arming his regime by chemical weapons. The Islamic Republic has always stressed that those complicit in Saddam's war crimes must be brought to justice. Therefore, in the presence of the country's top officials, an international conference was held in Tehran to look into the legal and international claims of the Islamic Republic in this regard.
Many countries gave Saddam intelligence, political, economic, military, and media support. All the world witnessed that these countries all stood against the great nation of Iran, but the United Nations could not play its role. The UN did not declare the Iraqi regime as the aggressor and the perpetrator of war. This is the question that the international community must ask the UN. Why the Security Council did not stop the aggressor from committing crimes against the Islamic Republic?
In the face of the chemical attacks, the international community turned down Tehran's frequent requests for deployment of experts for field investigations, something that Iran's foreign minister blasted during this event.
The Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and non-civilians, and also the Iraqi people. In 6 or 7 reports by the United Nations, it was declared that the chemical weapons were first used against military forces and then civilians. But the United Nations does not have a good record in supporting international law, and during the imposed war, it did not even use the means to make power balance.
It was also stressed at this conference that the assassination of the former Iranian IRGC Quds Force commander General Qasem Soleimani is top on the agenda to be followed up as part of this plan. Thinkers and researchers from 17 countries presented their papers on the legal aspects of the imposed war on Iran. These experts, in both virtual and in-person methods, elaborated on how the foreign countries helped Saddam's regime in killing civilians. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argued that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The Gaza Strip began its coronavirus vaccination campaign using the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Medical workers will be the first to receive the jabs. The vaccination comes after long delays by the Israeli regime that only allowed a small shipment of the vaccine to reach Gaza last Thursday, after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations. Another shipment of the Russian vaccine arrived then through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing on Sunday.
Today, we begin the vaccination of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip, and God willing, we will be able to control the spread of the deadly virus and have herd immunity.
Nearly 55,000 people in the blockaded Gaza Strip have been infected with the coronavirus, mostly since late August 2020. Some 550 Gazans have also died of COVID-19.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most overpopulated areas in the world. Vaccination will play a major role in preventing the coronavirus pandemic and lowering the number of deaths in case we can manage to inoculate people as soon as possible. First doses would go to frontline medical workers, vulnerable patients, and the elderly.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip struggled for months to lower the coronavirus infection rates through strict measures. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
This vaccination campaign is one of the main measures of the Ministry of Health to control the spread of this pandemic, along with other protocols. This vaccine will give immunity to those who receive it and in turn will lower the number of daily infections.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices under the watchful eye of the international community.
As vaccination begins in the blockaded enclave, experts say Tel Aviv must end its illegal policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing proper medical care. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The highly anticipated February 22nd announcement is finally here, marking what the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls his roadmap out of lockdown, following pressure from members of his own Conservative Party to explain how he plans to reopen the country.
We cannot persist indefinitely with restrictions that debilitate our economy, our physical and mental well-being, and the life chances of our children.
But restrictions won't be lifted in one fell swoop. Measures will be conditional based on four tests, with the government set to examine the data at each stage before unlocking further.
One of the first places to reopen, schools, which the Prime Minister, not long ago, described as potential vectors of transmission, causing the virus to spread between households.
In the devolved nations of Wales and Scotland, pupils have already gone back to school. We asked a number of parents in London what they thought of their kids returning to classrooms.
Well, they've lost nearly a year of schooling, so they definitely need to get back to school.
As long as people are sensible and the schools, I think they've taken all the necessary measures to keep the children safe, then I'll be glad for him to go back to school.
There is still some risk involved, I suppose, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the vaccination program is going forward, and I hope this decision is supported by data.
Critics, among them leader of the opposition Labour Party, have criticised the government for missing the opportunity to jab the teachers and school staff.
If we'd used that last half term, that last week, to vaccinate teachers and school staff, we'd be having a better discussion about children back to school. But ideally on the 8th, I'll listen to what the Prime Minister says this afternoon. I hope he's got a good plan.
The government says it does, and that it hasn't vaccinated teachers and school staff for a reason.
There isn't strong evidence that teachers are more likely to catch COVID than any other group, because children are very, very rarely get symptoms or and serious illness from the disease. The value, the importance of vaccinating children is to try to stop the spread of the disease.
At the moment, although death and infection numbers have gone down, there are still almost 20,000 people in British hospitals with COVID-19, and it's going to take months before everyone gets their first jab. It remains to be seen if this is indeed the beginning of the end for lockdowns in this country. Saeed Fariza, London.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust, and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France, and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework about around this whole thing is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in 5 gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors, as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the UN Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of a swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they are not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action. More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battle fronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020. Under a UN brokered deal while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations.
The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. Now we invite you to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. When we talk about this concept of universality of justice in the eyes of Ali ibn Abi Talib, it actually covers the entire realm of the universe. Look at the example of the animal world. There was a person by the name of Ash'as bin Qais. He was kind of a hypocrite fellow who came to Amir al-Mu'mineen during the evening with a flask of honey. Although the item was sweet, but for Ali it was like a poison. Why? Because Ali realized that he has brought this as a bribery. There is a case of his in the court at that time in Kufa. So Ali asked him, "Asilatun, am zakatun, am sadaqa?" You know, what is this? This is wages for something, or this is in charity, or sadaqa? فَذَٰلِكَ مُحَرَّمٌ عَلَيْنَا أَهْلُ الْبَيْتِ. You know, this is haram for us, Ahlul Bayt, to accept such things. And so, Ash'as bin Qais says, no, this is a hadiyah, this is a gift from me. And this is where Amir al-Mu'mineen realized that, you know, he's just using this term, but he's using it as a bribery. And so he says, وَاللَّهِ لَوْ عُتِيتُ الْأَقَالِيمَ السَّبْعَ بِمَا تَحْتَ أَفْلَاكِهَا أَلَا أَنْ أَحْسِلْ أنا أعص الله في نملة أسلبها جلب شعيرة ما فعلته. Amir al-Mu'mineen was very clear by saying that even if I am given all the domain of the seven heavens with all that exists under its skies, in order that I may disobey Allah by as little as snatching one grain of barley from an ant, by Allah, I would not do so. Why? وَإِنَّ الدُّنْيَاكُمْ عِنْدِي لَأَحْوَنُ مِنْ وَرَقَةٍ فِي فَمِ جَرَادَةٍ تَقْوَمُهَا. For me, your world is less in value than the leaf in the mouth of a locust that it is chewing. This is where we have to realize that, you know, when it comes to Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's not willing to compromise on the value of justice, even when it comes to snatching one grain of barley from an ant. Because according to Amir al-Mu'mineen, justice is something which is even more important than the issue of charity. And this shows very clearly that, you know, the goal does not justify the means. Even the means of reaching to the goal must be based on justice and righteousness. So this was about the animal world. Look at the humans. When Amir al-Mu'mineen appointed Malik al-Ashtar, his very trusted companion, as the governor of the province of Egypt, keeping in mind that Egypt was the former province of the Eastern Roman Empire and many of the citizens of that province were still Christians. And this is another important point that, you know, Muslims conquered many surrounding lands around Arabia, but it does not necessarily
translate into forcing their faith on those people. So although Egypt was already under the control of the Muslim rule, but the citizens were still not all Muslims. And so keeping that in mind, he wrote an epistle, a kind of a document of governance that he gave to Malik Ashtar, alhamdulillah. That document has survived,